Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything we think we know about food. I'm Anthony Zara, and this episode was recorded live at the Food Matters Live Tastes of Better event held in Ascot in April 2024. In this session, our panel discusses food allergens. Now, food allergies affect millions of people, and when food providers get it wrong, we know the consequences can be catastrophic. So it's vital that we all know about the latest research and keep on top of the current rules and regulations. Is your company fully up to date? Are your processes as safe as they could be? And could small changes help you increase your customer base? Your host is Head of Environmental Safety at Shield Safe, Rob Easton.
Welcome to this afternoon session on allergens. I'm really, really pleased that you've joined us. It's an important subject. That's why we're here. Hopefully that's why you're here to hear the update. We know when it goes wrong, it goes catastrophically wrong. Absolutely. And the impact that it has on individuals, the impact it can have on the food business, we often forget that. The team members, we were chatting over lunch. The impact, it just, when it goes wrong, it is catastrophic. But also what we know is when it goes right, when we understand the needs of our guests, when we have a product that can meet them, and we have, you know, Ryan and Mitch here, we'll be talking about that as well. It's an amazing opportunity. We know that 1% of the population are hypersensitive to allergens in adults, further 1% are celiac, 6% are children. Yes, we're looking at this marketplace. Roughly right, precisely wrong, they're FSA figures. what you'll get with this, it was their latest update. What you get with that, truthfully, the problem is, and I'm sure Caroline will talk about this, is data is mixed, data from different countries is mixed, but that's roughly what the FSA is saying at the moment. What it means is you can argue the exacts, but there's a huge opportunity. Get it right, understand your guest need, and there's a massive opportunity there. So to represent such a big hitting topic, we have this panel with us today. I'm going to do a brief introduction to each, and they will introduce themselves fuller. So at the end, we have Ryan, who's joined us from Borough 22, CEO, owner, creative genius, and he has bought a load of glazed donuts as well. So obviously, you'll be bringing your insight around what makes a fantastic product, and you're showing how you take that to market. We have Mitch, who brought some cheese. Quite frankly, I don't know. I'm slightly disappointed. We've got donuts, we've got cheese. Mitch is going to also talk about what does it mean to have a great product and the guest experience. And yesterday you were just at the awards, wasn't it? And you'll bring Free From Awards, bring some of the insight from the discussions there yesterday. The next we have Caroline. I've the pleasure of knowing Caroline for many years, seeing the great work that she does with clients, understanding their management of risk from allergens, auditing, also the white paper on near miss reporting, which I'm sure we'll cover off as well. And then finally, last but not least, is Natasha, who's a, if I get this right, solicitor advocate, specialising in food safety and allergens. And you'll have seen the brief today. A lot of it is around horizon scanning, so I'm warning you already, some of the first questions are coming your way.
Thanks.
But before we get cracking, before I introduce myself, would you like to add anything into the description I gave Ryan? Would you like to sort of a little bit about your background and what brought you to your interest in food and allergens?
Yeah, so I've not got a background in food at all. I'm a bricklayer by trade. It's a wet trade. I think baking is a wet trade as well. I just started the company purely for my children. They had allergies, and I just got fed up with them being in environments where food was available, but they couldn't eat any of it. It would make them physically ill. So I wanted to produce something that would, A, keep them safe, that they would be safe to eat, B, their friends would see it and they would want to eat it as well. It would be visually appealing. And then, something that didn't compromise on taste. So they wouldn't eat it and be like, oh, like, this is okay. I wanted it to be as good as, if not better than, its standard counterparts. That's the whole reason why I started Borough 22. And those three pillars have really carried us through to where we are today with this award-winning product.
Brilliant, thank you. We look forward to trying it. Very good, thank you, Ryan. Mitch, if you'd like to introduce yourself.
Hi, everyone. So I used to run my own ready meal company called Mitch's Kitchen. It was vegan, gluten-free and nut-free, basically because I was vegan and gluten-free and thought, actually, after a long day, when I get home to cook, I've been cooking all day as a chef. I don't want to then cook further. So how can I just have something that's healthy, delicious, and that I can eat? And at the time, there wasn't really anything on the market. It's changed a little bit, but it's still a little bit lacking. So I did that for a few years, and it's brought me to where I am now. So now I work as head of sales for Perezza, who are a vegan pizzeria. We've got sites in Brighton, Camden, and Manchester. But you could be gluten-free, nut-free, soy-free, and we can give you an amazing experience of pizza or pasta or all sorts of other things. So great from that perspective. And I also work for La Fromagerie, who make artisanal plant-based cheeses using nuts or butter beans as the base, but the exact same molds and fermentation process that you use in dairy cheese to give you proper mold-ripened, fermented camemberts and brie and blue cheese. So yeah, it's a really nice spectrum of anything to do with vegan cheese, I should be the person to go to.
I'll think of some questions quickly on vegan cheese. Caroline.
Thank you. So yeah, I'm Caroline Benjamin. I set up Food Allergy Aware back in 2013 when the new regulations came out and the hospitality were panicking and running around saying, what do we do? By my background, I'm a chef. I trained as a chef when I was 16. Things have changed quite a lot. I did think at that stage when the new laws come out that I would go out and try and produce food that could be created gluten-free and dairy-free. It took a long time for me to be diagnosed as gluten and dairy-free. And there wasn't a choice out there. There wasn't anything out there. But then, you know, most of the supermarkets and retailers were starting to actually do some really good stuff. So I went down the line of doing training for hospitality. So we offer consultancy training. We do a forensic audit on your allergens rather than just a normal audit that your food and environmental health officers might do to look at where you can enhance your systems and where you can get it right. As part of what we've been doing, I've worked with a lady called Jackie McPeat. So Jackie's based up in Manchester and I'm down here in the south. We set up hospitality allergen support. Talking about near miss reporting, we know very sadly that Natasha died from Natasha's loss, and Natasha had Nilaparous. It was reported afterwards at the inquest that actually about 6 to 7 families went to Pret and actually reported the fact that there was an issue. It might have been through social media, it might have been, you know, face-to-face, but there was at least 7 families, maybe more, that actually reported to Pret there was an issue on their labelling. Had they had done something at the time, had they had actually picked up on that near-miss reporting, Natasha might be with us here today. We might not have Natasha's Law and we might be, you know, in a different place. But, you know, we need to actually share best practice on that near-miss reporting. We need to make sure that we're actually logging it. And that's what you'll see some cards on your table today. And we'll probably talk about it a bit more. But, you know, the importance of near-miss reporting and how we can get it right and you know, making sure these we learn from our mistakes, which is the most important thing.
Perfect. And Caroline, if you haven't been along to the mock trial event that you've organised for many years, I was pleasure of speaking being there last year. It's fantastic. Great opportunity. You've got operators, you've got chefs in there, you've got regulators, you've got the consumer in the room. And it's a really great day where the presentation was first class, but also it was the conversations that were happening around it. So I'm not here to promote it, but it really is. If you see that coming up in the diary in the future, it's well worth attending. So I should say that. I don't think I've ever said that publicly.
Thank you.
And then Natasha.
I feel you've got 3 creatives here. Unfortunately, I'm the boring lawyer out of the group. So I'm a director at DWF and I sit in the regulatory compliance and investigations team. And so I deal with both contentious and non-contentious queries. So from a non-contentious perspective, that can be launching new products to market and happening with the labelling and presentation of those products, or doing audits or looking at safety policies. And then from a contentious perspective, it can be basically helping the client from the moment that incident has occurred, dealing with the regulator firsthand, attending the interview into court with them, and then right the way through to representing them in Crown Court. So kind of cradle to grave from that perspective.
Perfect. If it makes you feel any better, we've gone creative, legal, rat catcher. it's a nice way of introducing. I'm Rob Easton. I'm head of environmental health at Shield Safety. The title gives it away. My background, I'm an environmental health practitioner, and I've spent the last 25 years supporting businesses in the UK and abroad improve, well, understand, first of all, and improve their food safety culture and performance. I'm a Chartered Fellow of the Chartered Institute of Environmental Health. I'm a Fellow of Institute of Leadership Management, Fellow of the BII. That's my favourite one, because that's pubs. my role is has been as a regulator, as a consultant. And my interest really is how do we support businesses understanding the risk and improving. And we have a number of clients. If you don't know Shield Safety, I know some of you do well. That's what we do. So I'm really proud to be here today and to host this panel. And hopefully we'll bring all of those interesting views, perspectives together.
So let's crack on with some questions. It says, I believe in there, it's about the legal horizon. So, Natasha, sorry, I warned this. It would be great if you could give a, you know, what is on the horizon? What should we be aware of? And it may be, it's a new bit of legislation. It may be an interpretation of an existing. What's out there that's happening at the moment that we should be aware of?
Well, where do we start with allergens? I mean, the law hasn't stopped really for a while, has it? You know, we obviously had Natasha's law that's in place now for a while, but I think the one that's probably on, you know, the forefront of everybody's mind is the discussion around the Owen's law. Obviously, that's just been recently debated, again, by the FSA at their recent board meeting, and we've seen some progress go from a perspective of where we weren't going to mandate information on in a written form to now looking like that they're going to write to the ministers now to see put that in place. And to go back a step, so obviously, as we all know, food business operators at the moment can provide allergen information in non-packaged products via written information or orally. Obviously, if we do it orally, then we have to have a sign or a stamp to say, speak and get further information. Whereas Owen's law, what is currently being campaigned by the family is slightly different in the sense that they want the allergen information to be present on the menu itself. And I think where, from recent discussions we've got to, is that it's going to be mandated, well, they want to push for it to be mandated in written information, but maybe not so on the menu. We don't know what that's going to look like yet. Now, is that going to be a major change for businesses? Probably not, because I think a lot of businesses that have got an allergen matrix or they've got the information back of house so that they can have that conversation, because we know we have a lot of seasonal workers and we have front house, back of house policies, and it just makes common sense to kind of have that policy to hand so that somebody can refer to it. So I don't think it's going to be a major change for businesses, but I do think it's just something to be aware of now. It won't be a choice for food business operators. We're now going to have to, you know, you will have to have that written information, and I think we'll see more on that. Obviously, with the general election coming up, we'll see if that obviously halts things, probably will. And then the other thing I think that's still being debated and is probably on the horizon and has been on the horizon for a very long time is precautionary allergen labelling. As we know at the moment, PAL is voluntary. It's not a mandatory requirement. You don't have to put it on there. But as when I speak to my clients, you know, I always say if you've risk assessed and you've done all your checks and your balances and you can see that you actually can't, you know, get rid of that allergen in your manufacturing process or in your kitchens, then it's best to give that information to the consumer. Now, the problem we have at the moment is we know we've got some food business operators that have undertaken all of those risk assessments and are putting that label on a product to really show to the customer, you know, have a chat with me, or you may need to be aware. And then you've got the opposite end, where they've stuck it on as almost a disclaimer and be like, well, we're fine now because we've put that on the label. And the problem that we've got is consumers can't tell the difference. They don't know which one's which. And so we're seeing people taking more risks with their products they're purchasing. You know, I've seen many stories come about saying, it said may contain, but does it really maintain? Or is it just a disclaimer put on the product? So we tried it and actually, unfortunately, that was a product that did have cross-contamination there and they were poorly. So I do think there needs to be more done in this space. And I think, you know, there's lots of debate about allergen thresholds and what that's going to look like. And as we said, we were talking about this earlier on, I think there's still a lot to be done on that. It's obviously really scientific based, but what's the norm of a sensitivity? You know, where are we going to say is the level for, you know, the different categorizations of who would have a reaction at what level, and how do we then standardize it? I think from my perspective, when I'm advising clients, it'd be great to have a threshold, because then we can level the playing field out and everybody can work to a consistent measure. And then when you've applied that on a product, you know, everybody's had to do that. We know what that means. And then there won't be those risk-based decisions made by the consumer. They'll know exactly what they're getting. If it says may contains, they know it has to be to that level. Like when you have your gluten, you know that has a level. So I think they're the two big things I can think of that are still being debated. But I don't know if anyone else is seeing anything.
I think going back to what you were saying about thresholds, I think it's really difficult. It's one of those difficult areas. Each person with an allergen has a different threshold. They're not all the same for everybody. And then it can be affected by alcohol. It could be affected by sport. It could be, you know, affected by different features that are going into that. So, again, the threshold thing is so, so complicated. I think they've set some in one of the countries in Europe. I think it might be the Netherlands. But even so, there's a lot of controversy over may contains and what have you. I mean, I've been to a cafe. I think it was an airport cafe. And they had may contains crustacean in their coffee. And you're like, what are they doing? Literally, it's like,
there's a point where you go, do you know what? I'm not trying the coffee.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, so you're, you know, those things are there. But there's a lady called Alexa Barakaya, and she's been an advocate for allergens for quite a long time. Her little boy Sydney came to my event in 2013, and we talked about, you know, when the law came out, and literally she spends hours on the phone to manufacturers asking them about their processes, you know, this may contain, is it this, is it that, is it, and trying to get more information just so that her son can get inclusive. So, you know, what you're doing is really important, and not having a may contains on the free form product is so, yeah, important.
And also, you can't.
Yeah, exactly.
And from a business perspective, because obviously the legislation's there, Karen, are you seeing anything about how well business, are we getting prepared? Are we almost going too early? Because you know, often we see this, there's a hint some legislation's coming, and then what you'll see is there'll be these people popping up professing, well, we've got the answer, it's this amazing piece of software or something. What are you seeing out there? What's your experience of the businesses you're working with?
I'm seeing on social media that there's a lot of scaremongering going on with some of the software companies saying, Owen's Law's coming, you need to adopt this right now, what it's going to be. As we said, we don't know what it's going to look like in writing. It could be in software, it could be on the menu, it could be on an allergy matrix, or you might have an option of those ones that are there. So I think businesses aren't rushing out to do a lot of planning at the moment. It doesn't seem to be that way. A bit like when the law came in 2014, or, you know, when the 1169 came in, people weren't rushing out to do what they need to be doing. I think we need to take a step back and know about it. I think it's going to take a while. The FSA, if they adopt it, it'll take 18 months to 2 years before it goes down that route as well. So, yeah.
And as I said earlier, I don't think it's going to be a major mandated change for most hospitality businesses. I think they'll have those written information at the back. I think it may change if it's mandated in a specific way. It might be then you have to change things. I think, from my perspective as well, if we're going to be mandating on menus, that could be quite difficult. With supply chain disruption at the moment, if products are swapped out or seasonal menus, I think actually that's going to be... that will be the element that I find clients will find difficult to get on top of. Not actually the provision of the information, just what happens if on that day the supplier's changed it and then that menu is then legally incorrect and you've not provided the information. It's all those workarounds and having those backup policies that if something happens like that, you won't be able to make up the menu, you're thinking about a large chain, you wouldn't be able to make up the menu quickly, but how do you then provide that information and be compliant with the law? Yeah. It's those things that I think we need to be thinking through.
Totally, which of course with calories, you know, to draw a comparison is, you know, you've got that leeway on the calorie labelling, which allows for portion size, it allows for a substitution of a product, you know, it's there, but with there's no
which
leeway, there's no,
no.
It may or may not be, you know, and it's what we swapped in today, so yeah, it's really interesting. And that's what makes the subject for me is when you're looking at the life of the food, the guest journey, is there so many places where it can go wrong, isn't it? And that can be in the menu design, it can be substitutions on the day, it can be that team member just not getting the brief and understanding, it has to capture that. The reality of, you know, for the clients we were talking about in hospitality, this isn't a linear production line, it's not a food factory, and hospitality particularly challenging. Fascinating. From Rich and Ryan, does that fill you with dread? You know, you're hearing this coming down the line, or you're going, actually, the way that we operate, this is, yeah, we're good.
Yeah, it's very much like from my point of view, starting off as a home baker, which is where the business started. It's just a very much a common sense based approach, and just having that approach, it's completely separate in our house anyway, because we had allergies. We were pretty much an allergen-free kitchen anyway.
Of course, yeah.
But just applying that common sense and just looking at the laws that have come into place, it is just common sense that's being applied. It's just trying to buck what has become the norm. And sometimes bringing in change, I feel, just is very difficult to do sort of in the mainstream. But applying a common sense rule to things has kept us... I personally am not worried. There will be small changes that we will have to make, but they're only small. And it makes sense.
I'm interested. I read that you moved location recently to Karma Kitchens, isn't it? And there was an article this morning. I don't know if you... this isn't to make me sound clever. It came up on my feed when I was walking the dog. It was the Telegraph. I was talking about Karma Kitchens and the ghost kitchens, the dark kitchens, the massive growth in them. How do you find, if you don't mind me asking, that management of allergens in an environment where it's not your sole domain? You know, there are shared spaces. Is that created you a problem? Did you go in there with your eyes open? Or are you going, oh, Rob, don't mention it. It's a nightmare.
Yeah, it's actually okay because the kitchens themselves are all self-contained and everything is done within the kitchen. So it only comes out when it's completely sealed and ready for our delivery drivers to pick up. Or if it's going out to a wholesaler, again, it's completely sealed. The only allergen that we do not say that we're free from is nuts, because obviously that's a different ball game. But we're open and honest with people. I find that's always been the best way. And we encourage people when they're making an order, even like looking at what they've ordered, the specific donuts that they've ordered, if they've ordered them, some that are or a box of donuts that don't contain any nuts, then we'll contact them and just ask a few questions or encourage them to ask us. Because I feel that's, from a personal point of view, if you have allergies, you almost feel like you can be a nuisance when you go out asking questions. Some people are really vocal and really in your face with it. A lot of people are not. They're quite timid. They don't want to make a fuss.
Yeah.
And it's nowhere the opposite. Like, we encourage you, like, ask us the questions. We will tell you our processes, what we do. And if you're happy with that, then, you know, we can work together. If not, then we'll go our separate ways.
And isn't that the crux of it? We talk about, you know, the legislation around the 14-hour is about communication. It's about informed decisions. What you're doing is really leaning into that and encouraging that discussion.
Absolutely.
Rather than leaning back and going, and we've seen examples of just, I'm a weird, yeah. Shut it down. This is not a conversation. What I like, Mitch, I think we've covered the sort of the legislation coming over the horizon. What I should say at the end, there's a chance for discussions, questions. We'll leave plenty of time. I think one of the other ones, and I'm coming to you, Mitch, I hope you don't mind, is around vegan. You know, there's this vegan free from claim. We know there's been so many cases whereby, you know, the assumption is vegan is free from, and there's been deaths as a result of it. Two bits of research. I know, Caroline, you talked about one, which was one of the training providers. Wasn't
yeah,
it?
They've done a report. So High Speed Training have done a vegan report, but also the YouGov survey that they did. 72% of all participants believe that vegan food does not contain any ingredient derived from animals, making it safe for individuals with allergies such as milk, eggs, fish, and crustacean. So when people are going out and they're buying a vegan product, they think it is actually free from stuff, but it can be and may contain. So I think it's having that thin line if you're free from. And I think also, you know, the fact that it could be a may contain meat as well. I think, you know, if you're vegan or plant-based, you have to figure out, you know, that minefield of that legislation and that labelling.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was going to say, it was a big thing. Like, so I did judging at the Free From Awards yesterday, and Free From Awards, unlike Great Taste, where it's just solely focus on the taste. It's what's the product in front of you, taste it. You're really diving into what's in the ingredients, what's the cautionary labels, like what's actually declared on pack. So you don't see the producer, but you see all this extra information. And there was, amongst the judges, everyone kind of had differing opinions based on personal kind of experience, whether that's they're vegan or they're gluten-free because of a child or something like that. But essentially, the brands that did the best were the ones that were actually like, we are gluten-free, milk-free, or whatever. Our factory does not handle these products. Because it's giving the customers that clarity of, if you see something that's free from in the awards, then it's clearly been judged under this tough criteria. And I think as a consumer, it's nice to have these kind of call-outs. Like for Parezza as a restaurant, we are a vegan pizzeria, but I went there back in 2016 as vegan and gluten-free. I wouldn't have known it was a gluten-free pizza or a vegan pizza. So you can come in with a nut allergy, a soy allergy or something, and we're very hot with our staff in terms of training for making sure everyone knows what's in the ingredients. They have access. So if a customer comes in going, oh, I'm allergic to chickpeas or something like really random, like our mozzarella is made from aquafaba, which is chickpea based. And someone comes in and go, oh, I can't have chickpeas. And be like, oh, well, we've got this alternative or we can do this for you. So it's making sure as a hospitality provider, making sure your staff know all these things. And also from a due diligence and duty of care perspective, like as a company, that's just been part of our ethos from the beginning to go, actually, how can we make it as inclusive as possible? Because Italian food in general, like the main chains are actually getting so much better at it. They're probably one of the safe ones where if you are gluten-free or vegan, you can probably go to most major chains and have a gluten-free pizza or a vegan pizza. But in general, Italian food is all gluten, dairy and
all the good stuff.
So to just double down on that and focus on it is why like we've got the three sites and it keeps growing. And for me, I can take anyone there, friends, family, vegan or not, and they'll just have a great pizza. And I think it's that taste still has to win.
It's really interesting there because we've talked about the safety, but there's this whole thing around guest experience, isn't it? You know, so what is the guest experience? And talking about hospitality now is, you know, people go into hospital. We were talking about hospitality just now, weren't we? And great hospitality companies. What's your view on
managing risk and guest experience. You know, have you got any thoughts on it, your experiences? Ryan, maybe your experience with Borough 22 is, yeah, how do you, of course, you want to inform, but my son is allergic to gluten, and he's so very aware that he feels, yeah, if he makes a fuss, he feels like it's the birthday cake coming out with a sparkler in it and there should be, you know, streamers going off. All he wants to do as a 15-year-old boy is sink back into the background and not be seen. So I was just wondering if your sort of your experiences there of how do you think guest experience and safety interwoven?
It's a tricky one for us because we're at a crossroad now. So we've taken investment and we've gone into a commercial space and we're about to rebrand. So it's changing completely, and we had discussions around, okay, we are plant-based, we are gluten-free, we are almost top 14 allergen-free. Most of our donuts are top 14 allergen-free. Do we want to emphasise that? Because although we want to be the option, the go-to option for people who suffer with those allergies, which are indiscriminate, so our target audience is very, very wide. But it just means that they're like our strap line now is donuts for all. Like anybody can have them. Yeah. So you don't have to be plant based.
Is that inviting everyone here to have one of the donuts? That's what they're waiting for.
I'm doing mental maths actually, thinking how much I've got and how many people are.
The bad news is you've got a quarter of a donut each and maybe some grated cheese.
You'll start to see some people edging more towards the front.
There's one with my name on it.
I think just to add to that, on the weekend I had went to the coffee truck that's pulled up on our estate. It's dangerous now because I know most of the cakes are vegan, but they're not labelled as vegan cakes. And I spoke to the people and I was like, is there a reason you haven't called them vegan? And they were like, well, we tried it before. We'd mark everything down as vegan and they wouldn't sell because non-vegan consumers would go, oh, I'm not vegan. It's not for me. It's going to taste different. Whereas when they don't label it as vegan, like me being vegan or gluten-free, it's like in the past, it's you know to ask, we'll go, oh, what can I have? Like, can you tell me what I'm okay with? But to the average consumer, if you just see a Biscoff bar and you're like, yep, sold, I want that. And it always sells out first if it's not labelled as vegan. So I shared that on my LinkedIn and the engagement I've had on it from Monday, it's just rocketed with so many people saying, well, yeah, like if I'm not vegan, like it's not for me, or I've had a bad experience. So it's that bad first experience thing is another really big thing. But then it also then ties in with brands. So as a vegan cheese producer, it's like, how do you encourage non-vegans to try your great cheese? Because vegan cheese in general has such a bad first experience for people going, I tried a vegan cheese, it was terrible, I'm going to leave the category because I'm not vegan. But also then with the allergen side, you still need to go, well, ours are actually made from nuts. So we kind of have to communicate balance that.
Yeah.
Like, so it's interesting. So I think fromagerie as a name is a really clever play on words because it's like, well, fromage, it's like a nice kind of like, come to us, like try it, see what you think.
Very good.
And I'll jump in on that because obviously at the moment there is no legal definition of vegan. So, and that creates a load of difficulties because at the moment we've got this real, as you were saying, consumer perception of what vegan means and, you know, that you expect it to have zero animal products in, whereas actually we just have to go back to basic food safety principles when we don't have a legal definition. So we have to go back to the food is safe and that it doesn't mislead in the presentation or the labelling. So in reality, that means that there should be no primary ingredients in that product that come from animals. But what that doesn't mean is that there's no risk of cross-contamination, or it wasn't made in a manufacturing setting that, you know, there could have been previous products on the line that had animal thing. Whereas that's completely different to free from, which is picking up on your point, which is when you move into that space, that's an absolute claim, as we were discussing earlier on, that's a safety claim. And to be able to label something as free from, which again has no definition, so the law is letting us down here. But you're not saying a dietary requirement, you are saying a safety claim. So that person expects that allergen to be as, you know, not absent as much as possible. You've gone through vigorous testing. You know, your product has got the lowest detectable levels, we say. Whereas vegan, that's why you'll see, although the vegan society allows there to be a trademark stating it's vegan, as we've said earlier on, you'll still see a may contain because you're giving information in different ways. And I still advocate that there should still be a may contain if there is a cross-contamination perspective, because somebody may choose to have a vegan product from a dietary perspective, but actually if somebody's looking at that product to ensure it doesn't contain allergens, if there is a potential for cross-contamination, then we should be informing the consumer of that so they can make that, you know, a really informed choice when they're purchasing the product. And until we have a legal definition, I think we're in kind of this lacuna. We can't, you know, we're going to see vegan products with may contains for a while because the customer has to have that information to understand what is safe for them alongside a dietary requirement. Yeah. So they're kind of competing interests at the moment, unfortunately.
Yeah.
we've been in contact with the Vegan Society, and we've sort of said, if you have someone that's accredited, maybe you should have two different accreditations or accreditation like an A+. So if it's a free-from product that's vegan, it should be an A+ on the logo. And then perhaps if it's a may contain, they need to have an MC on the accreditation. So people can see at first glance exactly what they're looking at. But at the moment, their objection really to that is that they'll lose the amount of people wanting to do the accreditation because they have to go through rigorous testing and they have to go through that. Well, to be fair, welcome to our world when you're going through the free-from stuff. You know, that's what you have to do. And I think, you know, the Vegan Society a little bit are losing a trick. And then going back to what you were saying about customer service and not identifying it as a free-from product. So One Aldwych is a five-star hotel in London. I don't know if any of you know One Aldwych. I don't know if you've ever been there. But Indigo Restaurant in 2016, Dominic Teague, who's the executive chef, decided that he would create a free-from menu, because so many people were coming in and asking for gluten-free or dairy-free or nut-free. And he was like having to make changes to the recipes and the menus. So he decided to just go completely free-from. But he didn't tell anybody for 6 months. They just went and they just had that menu. People were eating it and said, oh, that's amazing. It's really fantastic. They do a Charlie and the Chocolate Factory afternoon tea. You would not be able to tell the difference between the free-from one and the normal one. You can't tell the difference. It's there. When they announced it to the public or whatever, they put it in the Evening Standard. There was an article. The bookings went up by 30%. And that took into account the bookings for the spa and the hotel bookings. A lot of Americans would go there because they know they can go there to eat and they're there. Their ROI at the moment is about 12.5% per year. So it goes up in the year. I go there to eat. To be fair, I don't normally go to five-star hotels, but I went there a couple of months, about 6 weeks ago, maybe a bit less, for dinner. I do get a free glass of champagne when I go, which is actually a bonus. But, I had three-course dinner. You know, my son and I had a three-course dinner. I don't get the chance to have three courses normally, but if I can, I will. I will spend that money. But, you know, we went out for my birthday. It was a big birthday in January. And I talked to them before we went, can I have a pudding, a dessert? They didn't have any puddings that we could have. Six and five and a little one. We went home and I had my own ice cream from the ice cream that I make because I couldn't have a pudding. But that was £60 that venue lost because they didn't have that pudding.
I think that's a really, really key point. That I do a lot of work in food service. And the one thing that I always try and home to customers whenever I've been trying to sell products is don't underestimate the power of that one fussy customer. Because whether it's a dietary preference or an allergy, if you're the person who in the group has to choose where you're going to eat, you're going to go somewhere that you know is safe for you. So you could sway the decision of 5, 10, 15 people. Like if I've, even on a stag do, it was like, I was the awkward vegan who was like, no, let me, I'll do the research.
Is that your nickname, by the way?
Yeah, the awkward vegan.
The awkward vegan. That can be your handle.
So yeah, I had to basically say, well, let me do some research. Look, here's some options, like tell me which to go. But I basically just erased so many places that didn't even have a single option other than just a few times it was like, fine, I'll just have chips. It's fine. Like chips, there's always chips.
Yeah,
my son's not always. The same.
Not always.
Sometimes we're weak.
Yeah,
always.
My son's the same.
I'm just aware of the time because we need to leave some time for questions. There is one thing I'd just like to carry, near miss reporting. I think it's an area. It is talked about by the Food Standards Agency. It's there in Owen's Law about this reporting. We talked about RIDOR, in the world of health and safety, which I also do. You've got this very strong piece of legislation around RIDOR, and we know that's made a difference to health and safety performance. Thoughts on near miss reporting?
It's just such a learning curve. There's so much we can learn. We were talking earlier, so I worked for Pratt & Whitney. Don't ask how I got into this role, but I managed to do a role where you had to calculate how much it costs to overhaul an engine. One of those roles that you get into and you think, oh, my God.
Ryan's a bricklayer. Don't worry. You're in good company.
Yeah, I learned so much, to be fair, and I learned quite a lot on geography as well and about different things. But the aircraft industry, they have this huge safety quality systems, and they had a thing called ACE, which is Achieving Competitive Excellence. When I worked there, I was like, oh, my God, I had to do 10 online courses, and then I had to do it 2 every quarter, and then I had to do reporting. You had to find, it was called a turn back. You had to rise turn backs and find things. They made you look to see where things could go wrong in your business. And I was then doing admin, so goodness knows what it's like on the shop floor. Because literally, if you have a screw which is sheared on an aeroplane and it goes wrong and it's put on that aeroplane, I think they've had some recalls, haven't they, with Boeing just recently. Literally, that recall is going to cost a fortune. It's like an arm and a leg, and it's, you know, that's somebody's life. That's someone's life you're taking your hands. Within the food industry, and I compare it to the food industry, you're making food, whether it's manufacturing or food in a hotel or restaurant, you're preparing food and it could kill somebody. Literally, it could kill somebody. And literally, you don't want that on your agenda going forward and in your life and, you know, living that regret. So it's really important that we pick up on little mistakes, even if it's just like sprinkles on a coffee. We did an audit and they had a dishwasher, a glass washer. It was in the middle of the ocean. And they had a glass washer and they had loose nuts on the bar, peanuts on the bar. They were washing the glass bowls in the dishwasher, which was recycled water. And it was like, have you not even thought about that danger? And then, yeah, and what would happen if something went wrong? And literally that was like a red flag. It was like instantly was like, you need to stop this and do that. Little things that you might not have thought about that we need to pick up on. And it's just really important. So we've set up a database to try and capture that from both an FBO experience and from the food hypersensitive customer, not to name and shame, because that's not the point. We're here to share information. And I think if we can share best practice and if we can start collating some of those incidences, I mean, you were sort of saying about RIDOR and reporting, it only ever goes up to the Food Standard Agency. If somebody dies or somebody goes to hospital and it's a serious incident, local authorities around the country are not sharing information. They don't have a way of sharing any of those incidences, and we're trying to do that and capture that information and, you know, and try and make it a learning curve, really. So that's the sort of ethos behind it.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Yeah, because at the moment it's consumer-led, isn't it? So yeah, it will be a consumer who's had a bad experience almost certainly tipping off the local authority to have that site inspection. As you say, we don't have the same level as you would see in health and safety, which I'll do that as well for my clients, where, you know, there's been an incident and they have to self-report to the regulator via RIDOR. We don't have that system in place for allergens. You know, there are certain instances that may fall into that, but it's quite discreet, which obviously from my client's perspective is quite good, because they're not yeah, having to report to the regulator and yeah, put it on their radar that they've cocked up, basically. Yeah. And they can get on top of it quicker. And as you say, then it's, you do that risk assessment yourself to say what went wrong, how do we make sure it doesn't happen again, and they can get on top of it. So if the regulator does do a site inspection, they're on top of it. But I do think we'll start to see that, as you say, there's been discussions on this about a national register, and I think we'll start to see continued discussions about where that's going to move to, and if we'll see some triggers to make there be some better reporting schedule regarding near misses or where there has been an incident, so that local authorities, because, you know, there's no cash at the moment, is there? There's not the money to go out and do the site inspection. So they need to be targeted in those inspections.
It has to be data-led. Yeah, so that's what we know. And we know this from RIDOR. It provides an amazing data set that you can go, this is an industry, it's a sector, it's this particular process. And it's tried and tested in LAC 67 from the Health and Safety Executive. This is what the data is telling us. It's a scarce resource. Go and focus on that. And we don't have that in food safety. We don't have that in allergens. And I think that's it's that businesses can learn, but it's that targeting what is a scarce resource.
Definitely. And I think, like with RIDOR, if an incident, allergen, as I understand it, if an allergen incident happens in your restaurant, your hotel, and that person goes to hospital, you have to report it. If that person leaves your place of work and they have an allergy incident, it's not so much reportable, and those ones are the ones that are not being captured. And again, the customer doesn't always know where to report to. So on that website, it does actually tell you to go back to the venue. It tells you where to go to with your local authority, you know, how to find your local authority, because it's really important. Because how do people report? How, you know, festivals, I don't know if you've ever tried to go to a festival and they've had an incident. Who do you contact? Do you talk to the ticket people? Do you get to the venue? Literally, even when you're trying to find out if you can eat there, you don't know who to report to. But if you've had an incident, there's just no way of doing that information.
The good news is the CIH, hopefully we wrote the guidance in 2010 for the Olympics. It's the next bit of guidance we're updating. So
fingers, yeah.
That's on the number one priority to update it, because that sector, street food, festivals, has moved forward so far.
Horrendous.
So let's make sure we include that.
Yeah.
Just to jump in on that, obviously saying that you'd have to report if somebody went to hospital thing, it's slightly more nuanced in the sense of it depends if they've had treatment or what that looks like. So there's obviously two types of allergic reaction. You've got your IgE reaction, your non-IgE, so IgE being your anaphylactic reaction, and non-IgE being your hives and you know, your eczema or asthmatic basis. And obviously, I say this because I've got three sons and two of them have allergies, and ironically, because I did this law before I had my children. And it's been great from the perspective of it's shown me full circle of the difficulties that you can face if you're a consumer trying to get the information, and equally trying to defend corporates where they're trying to do their best in an oversaturated market, and they just, you know, there's not enough time or money to get on top of things. So with regards to if you've obviously got, my children didn't have anaphylactic reactions, thankfully, but they would never get treated in hospital because it would be, oh, you've eaten something, you need to go They're off, sleep attended. It, sleep, yeah. it or, sleep it off, you know, and take some antihistamine, you'll be fine. So I think that's what I mean, there's going to be more to look at here. What would trigger a RIDDLE report? Because with the health and safety incident, you know, you've got the 7 defined categories of injuries and they're very prescriptive about what you'd have to report and, you know, it says all that. And allergies don't really fall squarely into that at the moment.
No, it's a bolt-on.
What would the injury be? I know there's one about loss of consciousness, which you might have if you have an anaphylactic reaction, but, you know, where does that specifically sit? So I think there's more to be done in that area.
Definitely.
Amazing. I'm aware of the time. It's up to 5:30. Let's open it up to the floors. Look at that, straight in. Gah, eager. Very good. And by the way, I've got my phone here and I can see LinkedIn pinging away. So I think people are saying LinkedIn. So yeah, please do. I've got it for the time, but it's been flashing away.
It was interesting that Caroline mentioned the aerospace analogy because that was something I was going to bring up is if you take that as an analogy and you can sort of go with it, you know, when aviation first started, being a pilot and being a passenger was probably one of the riskiest things you could do. And then you fast forward to 2017, where there were no deaths globally in commercial aerospace. Is that you kind of getting that far as, let's say, in the UK, there are no allergy deaths within a year. Is that throwing the ball too far? Do you think there's the tolerance to get there? And what are the major barriers to getting that far?
Do you know what I went to do there? I went to answer it. That's not my role. So I'm going to shut up and I'll open up to the floor.
I think we do need to get the numbers down. And the only way we can do it is training and making sure that people are aware, the labelling's going to help. It's all the different points. There's so many gateways that we need to put in place to do it. But I think unless, you know, just example, at lunchtime, so I went for my lunch and they're like, oh, we've got an allergy matrix. And they're, oh, so what can I have that? Oh, we can't tell you. It's the law. We can't tell you. And then it's all that complete negativity. And literally it was like, then the lady started quoting to me, the caterer manager, she said, yeah, it's all to do with Natasha's Law. And I'm like, no, it's not. But literally, until we get that training properly in place, and, you know, the FSA training online is good, it's okay, but you need to go to the next level. You need to make sure your staff are aware. And the only way you're going to do it is create gateways within your business to make sure that you take allergens seriously. Because, yeah, that's the only way to get that numbers down. I mean, we're still seeing about 10 a year. I mean, the one that we saw, we talked about earlier, a lady died of a sesame allergy, but she didn't tell them. Like, literally, her parents ordered online. They never saw the sesame. The people where she ate asked the questions. They said to them, has anyone got an allergy? And she was, like, 24, I think, 24, 25, and she didn't, like, talk about it, so she didn't say anything. So she said nothing, hadn't had a reaction for 20 years or whatever, so she thought she was OK and didn't say anything. Again, you know, we're still going to have that communication from the food hypersensitive customer. Has to be a two-way conversation. We need to instigate a conversation and we need to make sure we're just pushing it all the time.
When I speak to my clients, I always say, you know, why did you get into hospitality? And it's to provide a service, to provide an experience. So, and that can be for anybody, you know. And if I saw this really, really unfortunately for you earlier on, Caroline, with, you know, give them the space, give them the time to ask for that information. You know, you've got a legal requirement to provide the information, but don't just give the information full stop, bang. Done my job, not going to speak to you anymore. You know, you've got to have that communication, and that works both ways. You know, you've got to have. I had a client the other day who was saying they had somebody come in and they said they were allergic to an ingredient and it wasn't in the top 14. Well, they didn't say they were allergic, sorry, and they said, oh, I just don't like it. And it took this duty manager who was quite switched on to say, is that a preference or is that an allergy? You know, speak with us, because we won't trigger a process for front of house and back of house if you don't tell us. And it took a good 25 minutes, and they finally admitted that they were allergic. And they weren't just allergic, they were the highest level, and they could have gone into anaphylactic shock. And so we're still miles away. I think both, there needs to be a lot of work done from food business operators, you know, continuing to push forward with the changes in the law. But equally, that, as you say, that communication piece is so important. But giving them the space that they feel, like you were saying earlier on, that they feel that they can have that conversation and they're not being rushed or a nuisance when you're in a place and, you know, you're looking through the matrix and you're harassed and the kids won't sit for more than 20 minutes and you've lost that window because you've barely got through page 2 of the matrix. You're like, do you know what? Forget it. We'll go home and eat because we're not even going to be able to order food. So, yeah, I just think there's a lot more to be done learn from both sides.
I think there's nothing more like disheartening than just being handed like the A5 fold or A4 folder of Matrix just to have to flick through. But I think it is, from an operator perspective, it's important to like try and streamline your processes. Like in a previous talk this morning, someone mentioned that Wagamama's, I don't know if it's correct, so I haven't fact-checked it, but apparently they don't use nuts on site. So
hierarchy of controls. Yeah. Brilliant. So health and safety again. The answer's
so
health
again,
and safety.
They just decided, actually, let's just go nut-free in our recipes. You're not missing anything by taking nuts out, but you're suddenly making it safe for people with nut allergies. So if that is the case, I'm not saying it is, double-check, please.
I can talk firsthand. So we're supporting a client who's... You talk about risk profile in an organisation, and we do talk about hierarchies of control. And what I'm saying is the culture, the ability of the organisation is to manage risk at this level, because that's the control systems, that's the governance, that's the training, the auditing you have in place. Then you have to make a decision. If you introduce a new, and in this case it was nuts, it was a new product, I was saying, of course you can do that, and you can look at your competitors, and we went to the States, and we went to Europe, and we did all this work. We're saying, but your organisation's not there yet. And that's what we're saying. So is know your risk, your inherent risk of your product, know how you're changing that, and is your system robust enough to manage it? And if it's not, then don't do it. and also know if you do change your risk profile to create a peak, know that there is a cost to that. There's a demand, there's a governance to it. So I know it sounds a bit geeky, but there is, businesses need to, you know, or with help, understand that risk profile, then actions that they can either reduce it or make sure that they don't add a peak in there. I think in answer to your question, Caroline said it's low at the moment. It's dropping. Dr. Hazel Gowland has done some amazing tracking over the last 10 years of prosecutions, number of deaths, and we're seeing prosecutions are going up, average prosecutions going up, deaths are falling. You know, they are still happening. And as we said, right as we kick this off, is, you know, the impact of that is the individual, it is the family, it is the people. You know, the one we always forget is having done fatal accident inquiries, is the team that are administering first aid. I had an interview a 19-year-old who the day before was giving CPR to someone. You know, when you're talking to a nut, you're going, this is the repercussion. So thankfully, it is very infrequently, but when it goes wrong, of course, nothing comes of it. It's tough. But what we don't want is zero reporting. Remember, we've got this, I go to a lot of manufacturing sites and they go 283 days without an accident.
You're like, yeah.
Not a great metric, because what happens, you don't want to be Dave who creates that accident, do you? So what you have is this whole culture of underreporting, because we have to, it's an admirable thing to strive for, of course it is, zero harm, but do not make it so it becomes, you know, it either businesses become so restrictive, so risk adverse, or actually this stuff's happening but no one wants to report it for fear of being Dave. I don't know who Dave is, but he sounds like a troublemaker.
And it's interesting because we contacted UK Hospitality when we set up the Near Miss stuff, and also the Food Standard Agency. So the Food Standard Agency at the moment is saying we're not going to implement it, because if you have a business that does all the near miss reporting and they log all their reports in there and they talk about what they've done, they put a system in place to counteract it, and they've done loads, and then you've got another business that's got none, how are you going to grade that business? Does it make the person that's doing all the reporting look worse than the one that's doing no reporting? So that's the problem they've got at the moment. Until they actually put some legislation around the whole thing, it's going to be quite difficult to be there. But I think it's just making sure it's not a tick box exercise. Literally having a matrix and putting your stuff and ticking it is not allergen management at all. You know, looking at how you provide for that customer is important.
Brilliant. I'm aware of time. How are you? So that was a great question. Thank you. Really, yeah. That's why we love the questions. There's no preparing for them, is there? Go on, is there any more out there before we...
So, you know, you say how people who have allergies, they're not necessarily so forthcoming in, like, a restaurant environment with telling staff. Other than the staff in the restaurant making them feel more comfortable, in a broader sense, how do you make people come forward and give that information? Because I find that striking, that someone who can have a super high level allergy to something wouldn't immediately come forward. I mean, that what a terrible state of affairs. But how, in a broader sense, do you encourage them to do that?
Great question. Ryan, Mitch, do you want to come from a...
So in Selfridges, like, we train the Selfridges staff. Anyone that comes to buy our donuts in Selfridges, they've got their own section of the counter, just to ask the questions. Like, if they're buying our donuts, they've got to be buying them for a reason. It could be that they're just delicious and they just love them. But the chances are that they're going to have some kind of allergy. So ask the questions, like, be really obvious, put on a new set of gloves, get a fresh pair of tongs, like, do that openly and invite the conversation. Because, like I said, you seem to get two types of people, those who are, like, really vocal and like will hair dry you with their comments.
We've had those.
Those who are really, really timid. So by inviting the conversation, creating a safe environment, making them feel like they're the only person in the room, I guess, that you're having that conversation with them, eye contact, smiling, everything, all of those types of body language, I think that's the best way to do it. It won't work every time. Everybody is different. But you'll certainly give an environment where it will encourage them to open up and tell you exactly what allergies they need to avoid.
I think it's being part of the culture as well. Like, obviously, it's down to the individual. Like, I'm vegan, but I won't cause a fuss. I'll kind of take things at face value because it's not going to kill me if I get it wrong or go, actually, I think that has some dairy and I can taste it. Like, it's just a preference for me. So I'm very aware of kind of how I approach it. But in the restaurant, it's like, if you come and sit down and you have a meal, the staff should be asking you, do you have any allergies? Do you know that this is... like we use chickpea, or like they'll kind of mention things, but it's from a kind of a passion and excitement point of view, like, oh yeah, our pepperoni is completely allergen free, or like whatever we kind of want to say. There's those kind of things that the staff have a duty of care almost to try and bring out the customer. So it is around that giving the safe space to make people feel like they're welcome and they know, actually, I can be like, I can air my concerns or what I can't have here because it's a safe space. Because I'm sure if anyone out there has specific allergies, you know you've felt like that awkward vegan or that awkward person going, sorry, I can't eat gluten and I'm vegan. And what, like, it just becomes you're like sinking down in your seat. So I can understand why a lot of the time, if you've got that backlash from wherever you've been, you might go, oh, I might just chance it. But like you said, if it's a severe allergy, I think it is, it's down to the individual at the end of the day. And there's only so much we can do.
We just said, if you may be familiar with the work organisation consultant called Beyond Philosophy. So they're the people behind Net Promoter Score. That's what they're most commonly known for. But they talk about destroying clusters. They talk about mapping a guest experience. Now, that's people who've done the Disney course or whatever. It's familiar language. They talk about planned hospitality, structured hospitality. And I know, Caroline, you do work with your clients as well, and probably from a defence point of view, is about really understanding what the guest journey is. And understanding their needs, wants, expectations. This is language we're familiar with about creating great environments. What you have to do is intertwine safety in there. So actually part of the guest journey is however you wish to present it in the language you present it, but you just know this is what happens every time a guest presents because this is what we do. And when we work with clients and they're saying we want to manage allergens, we want to manage that, I say, well, have you got a guest journey? Because until you've got that, why do you suddenly think that you can manage allergens as part of this? Because it'll be completely alien to your organisation. So the way, and why I say about defending, was we worked with a client. Unfortunately, there was a fatal accident. And what they were able to say, and we were under caution, you know, the team were under caution. And they said, we just do this. We talk about culture, it's habit. We just do this. We know that we ask the guests. They said, how do you know? We say, because we just do it. And what was amazing, the police then went and interviewed other guests that dined. And guess what? Every single guest was asked, but it was habit. It just happened. And if it's habit, if it's defined from Caroline's side, you can then audit it. You make that part of your survey, your team training. You do that as part of your observations. So, yeah, you will. This is a bold statement. You will never nail this unless you already have that structure in your organisation. You know, because if you're trying to bring in a pattern, something that is defined, in the other things need to be defined as well. If you just try and do it with allergies, it will fail because it's a bolt-on. It has to be part of the overall guest journey, in my humble opinion.
I agree with that. We see that a lot in defence cases. You know, it's that consistency in approach and making sure, especially with your larger brands where you've got multiple restaurants, you know, it's really difficult to make sure that you have young seasonal workers that will be in and out, and they'll, as you say, it's a tick box, a training, they'll just be like, oh, bum, 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 bum. But as you say, you've got to make sure that those policies are live. They're not just sitting on a shelf going dusty, that you eat, sleep, breathe in those policies, and they're just part of what you do rather than being, oh, if I look at this specific part of the law and have we discharged our duties, tick. It's just got to be inbuilt into what you do.
Yeah, and that's why we talk a lot about food safety culture. This is food, this is culture, this is the culture of the organisation, this is the habits within the organisation. It's not separate, it has to be part of it. And I'm really aware of the time. Before we started this session, they said, you've never got an hour's worth of material. And here we are having to wrap up and we've been chatting beforehand. So I'm going to say, I think we have to wrap up because other things are following.
If you have got questions, if you've got something specific, I'm sure the panel will be about for a bit. I'm looking for this crustacean coffee I've heard so much about and donuts and cheese. But it just leaves me to thank Ryan. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for the donuts. I'm desperately trying to get one, can you tell? Mitch, thank you also. Look forward to trying the cheese. Caroline, it's lovely to see you again. Natasha, thank you for your insight and fielding the first question, which is always the worst. So, yeah, and thank you for attending this afternoon. Please go safely.
Thank you for listening to that episode of the Food Matters Live podcast. Now, before we wrap up, we have some exciting news to share. Food Matters Live is returning this autumn with events in Ascot, Manchester, and for the first time, Dublin. Join us as we inspire the future of food. Whether you're looking to solve innovation challenges, explore positive nutrition trends, or learn strategies for sourcing sustainable ingredients, these events are designed for you. Learn more and sign up at foodmatterslive.com. We look forward to seeing you there.